You know, it's in a way, it's timely that you're here, because the first two murders in exceptional clearance occurred in, I'm pretty sure it was Brooklyn.
Yes.
And they were black women, uh-huh. and there was a great deal of fear in the book that this might touch off a racial panic. You must have some precognition or something to be able to plan the book in this fashion.
Most writers would like to do that. No, it's actually an accident. I worked in Crown Heights when I was a detective, and I know the area quite well. I just got an idea for Exceptional Clearance, and it just evolved. You know, you get an idea for a book, and I always let the book evolve itself. I don't do outlines at all.
You don't do outlines?
No.
You mean you just started writing? Well, you had this germ of an idea.
I get a germ of an idea, and I scratch it out on an index card. Mm-hmm. And then I'll come up with the name of my character, who's usually involved in the germ of the idea, and I sit down and I write. I don't understand how people can use outlines, to be honest with you, because a book has to evolve. A book has to take on its own life. Your characters have to become alive in your own mind and on the pages. And when you have an outline and you stick to that outline, you're not letting the story or the characters evolve into their own life.
Well, you don't have to stick to the outline. It's a guide. We here, yeah. for example, as an all-news operation, the producer of which I am one, we make up what we call a rundown sheet.
Right.
This rundown sheet establishes what stories we're using at a given time, the placement within the hour, what tape we're going to use, and sometimes, and this is given to the writer or the anchor person who writes also, maybe 2 hours before the broadcast, and sometimes at the last minute it's thrown out.
Right.
It's only a guide.
That's correct. But unfortunately, I know many writers who stick to that outline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I start writing, the first one or two pages, it evolves. It comes to life. And it's different. It's just different. The characters come alive. I'll start writing a man or a woman as a character, and I just think they're going to be a walkthrough, you know, a walk-on character, and all of a sudden they become a major character in the book.
Well, that's part of the pleasure for you, isn't it?
Yeah,
I've talked to other writers who tell me that their characters sometimes just spring to life.
They just
life
come alive.
And they're fascinated. They want to see where these characters go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The book comes alive as it evolves. It takes on its own life. It has its own life form. I mean, of the books I've written, all my characters are alive in my mind. I can see them. I can see Dan Malone, Gus Heinemann, Shaughnessy, Lucas. They're all there. And that's the gift of writing. You know, I used to think it was a skill and that you could go to school and learn how to do it, but that's not the case, I don't believe. I think you just have to have a gift. And a lot of people don't know they have the gift.
Well, I think you're right. It is a gift because most people can't do it. But also, I think that you would probably agree that when you write, it's kind of on-the-job training. Nobody can tell you how to do it.
You got to learn. It's on-the-job training, absolutely. And the only way to learn how to write is to write. Sit down with your pen and paper or your typewriter and just start in. Once upon a time, there was a guy named Joe Blow, and he walked across the street, period. And that's how you do it, and you learn your mistakes. You learn to that less is more. You learn not to overwrite. You learn not to use too many adjectives. Use them very sparingly. And to create your characters. And you learn how to breathe life into your characters.
Because you have a real advantage over a lot of people, especially people who want to write mysteries and thrillers and detective stories, because you have the police background. So all the procedural knowledge you have already in order
That's
to
write true. This book. I had 30 years in the New York City Police Department, but I still have to keep up. The technology changes so fast, you just have to keep up. Now the cops are starting to be issued Glock automatics. I had never heard of that, a plastic automatic 9mm hose 15 rounds. So I had to bone up on what it is, the nomenclature of this weapon. I might need that in a book.
You have a lot of information about police procedure in exceptional clearance, but in other police departments, are they essentially the same? For example, reports and files and documents and things have numbers, but what if it's the Seattle Police Department?
They have
is
the same
it different,
thing.
Or is it the same?
They all have forms. It's a bureaucracy, and you have to hold your people accountable, and one way of holding people accountable is paperwork.
Could you write a police story with a certain degree of confidence and set it in Seattle, say?
I think so. I've been out there. I used to work with the police commissioner of Seattle. And he was the New York City cop, by the way. Uh-huh. And, yes, I think I could. I've been in many police departments throughout the world. Every time I go overseas, I go to the local police. And I had a lot of work on black sand in Greece. I was with the Athens police, the Hellenic Police Department, I should say. And it's the same job. It is the absolute same job. It's just a different language in a different country. But cops are cops all over the world.
Well, I want to come back to you and ask you a couple of questions about how it all began for you.
Sure.
But before that, let's talk about exceptional clearance. You said that when you start a book, there's a germ of an idea. Tell me about the germ that launched exceptional clearance.
I had a lot of trouble with this book, I have to tell you. I originally started out, I was going to have a real vampire. I just gave the plot away. A real vampire. And I started to do research on vampires. And there was a whole body of academic knowledge on vampires. It's steeped in religious belief. A lot of the holidays of many religions are wrapped around vampires, or the belief in vampires. It's come down to this day. Many practices, religious practices, like the gravesite feast, hundreds of years ago, they did that because they wanted to feed the dead. The dead would stay in the ground and not rise up and kill them. And to this day, when you go to a funeral, they usually have a little feast afterwards. Coffee, cookies, cakes. That's where that comes from.
Why would you, just parenthetically, why would you initially want to write about a real vampire? Because your books have this very realistic approach.
I know. I that was the germ, and I was wrong. I couldn't do it. I started to work on the vampires, and I saw that vampires can't exist except in folklore and myth, because they can't. Human mouth is not made for predation. The human mouth cannot kill. Human mouth cannot get into the jugular vein or the common carotid artery. So then I had to have a crazy guy. And to write about criminally insane is difficult.
And you had to find a way for him to have a vampire-like wounds in his
system. That's correct. I had to find a way to have him be able to kill people that way. And it was very difficult. I spent a lot of time with the chairman of the Department of Prosthodontics at NYU. And he finally worked out a way. In fact, he may be my fangs. And that's how it came to life. Once I did that, the book came to life. Once I learned that it could be done.
Tell me about your lead character, who's a Portuguese detective, right, and a maverick.
That's correct. All New York City cops are mavericks. The wonderful thing about it is that, as the mayor says, we are a mosaic. And no one ever writes about the Portuguese. I love the Portuguese. I love Portuguese food. I love Portugal. So I figure, let's have a Portuguese hero. This way I can get a little color in it, a little color of that background, a little color of the country, a little color of Portugal and the United States, the Portuguese community here. And that's why I did it. I always do that.
And the lieutenant, whose name escapes me?
John Vinda.
Vinda forms an elite group to investigate these particularly horrifying homicides that go on throughout the city. Is this a normal thing to have a special squad set up like that?
They will form task forces, yes. Each borough command has a homicide task force and squads of detectives that work out of each precinct. When they have homicides, and they think it's a series of homicides, they will form task force, and they will just devote all their energies to that, i.e., the fellow who, Son of Sam, they had a task force for that. Joe Borelli, who's now the chief of detectives, led that task force. And they bring men in from all over the city, and they're assigned, and they just concentrate all their energies and resources on solving that case.
How many books have you written?
This is the fifth one.
You don't repeat your characters, do you?
No, I don't.
You have all fresh characters for every
All time? Fresh. Some of them I plan on. Tony Scanlon, my one-legged detective, I'll bring him back someday. But I just like to go on. I like new life. I like to create life through my writing. I just go on. I always say, well, the next book I'll bring Scanlon or Malone back. But somehow I just want to develop new characters. The one I have in the typewriter now I have is totally different from anything I've ever done before. And main character is totally different. And that's what I enjoy doing.
You're going to stick to cops, I hope.
Yes, I have to stick to cops. That's what I know best. I don't know anything about radio or television or newspaper work or advertising. I know cops, and that's what I'm going to write about.
Of course, you have a relatively sympathetic newspaper man who works for the New York Post, an old-time police reporter.
Still around.
Which are not many left in the
I park. Know. That's a shame. They used to have the news shack behind every borough headquarters, and they had old-time newspaper guys who were out there. They're like the truckmen, the newsmen who go out to interview people. Now, unfortunately, everyone's have a lot of personalities, a lot of stars in your business. They're not
too many newspapers left either.
Well, that's true. That's true. But none of them have cop reporters except the Post and the News.
They have what?
A cop, police reporters. Post does, and the News does.
Yeah.
The Times is, they don't.
No, they're all general assignment, I think. Most of the television stations have at least one police reporter. And there are
sometimes.
Gabe, what's his name?
Pressman.
Pressman and John Miller. And
John Miller's of Channel 5.
Mike Taibbi.
Yeah.
They specialize.
They specialize. And they really need to. I mean, John Miller's very knowledgeable on the police department, and he's very knowledgeable on organized crime.
We have a specialist here. Irene Cornell does our police and court reporting.
It's very involved. They really should have people in there. It has a lot to do with the community, and people are interested in it.
Well, you make contacts.
And you make contacts.
I know, being a street reporter myself over a course of many years, when you go to a crime scene, it helps to know somebody there.
Of course.
You find a sergeant or even an officer.
Of course.
You facts, and if you go there as a stranger, nobody's going to help you.
No, that's the human nature, isn't it? That's the way it is. They'll say go to the public information. And you get down to public information, and public information is only going to get on the phone and call the scene.
Well, they try to help. Yesterday, or day before yesterday, they arrested a man for the rape of an assistant district attorney.
I remember
in
that.
Brooklyn. And I worked on that story. I not only do books, but I do hard news here, too. And I called PIO, and the guy, he was a nice detective by the name of McConville. And he read me a statement, and I said, I'm trying to track down the investigating officer, and I finally got the investigating officer, a lieutenant in the special crimes squad in Brooklyn. And he was very good. He helped me. I got him on the phone, and he gave me everything I needed to know, a lot of background and this sort of thing. But it's always better to go to the source, and the PIO tries. At least they have it. I've worked in the boonies, and you call a small-town police department, they won't give you anything.
I know.
They're afraid of you, and they won't help. I used to work in a middle-sized city in Pennsylvania by the name of York. And I got to know a city about 90,000 maybe when I was there. I was a news director of this radio station. And I tried to get to know the police officers. They had a police force of maybe 75, small, maybe even not that many. And every morning on my way in to the station, I'd stop off and look at the complaint sheets. Sometimes they'd give them to you, and sometimes they wouldn't. Now, one day, you have to tell me if I did right or wrong on this. One day on my way to work, very early in the morning, they only had one squad car out overnight. I cut through a parking lot behind my building, and I see the squad car, and I see the motors running. And windows are steamed, so I go up to the squad car, I look in, and there's the cop. He's scooping. He's out in the back seat, sound asleep. So I tap on the window, and he wakes up. He's startled. And then I go on off, And later that day, I run into the police captain, Captain Cap, top uniformed officer. And I wanted to, I didn't want to put it on the radio. Now, if I'd been a crusading reporter, I probably would have put it on the air. One lone cop overnight, sound asleep in back of a squad car. You know, a nice story. One car, no protection in the whole city except for the sergeant, a desk sergeant.
Yeah.
But I was afraid to do that because if I did, I would lose all of my contacts.
Yeah.
So what I did, I told Captain Cap what I had seen, and I left it up to him to take any disciplinary action. Now,
was
the right thing to do?
Yes, I think that it was the right thing to do. You could have saved that cop's life, too, carbon monoxide poisoning. It's very dangerous. Many years ago, I remember an incident in the city where a cop was killed in a radio car, same way. He backed into a snowbank on the exhaust. He didn't realize he was in a parking lot, and he backed into a snowbank, and the tailpipe went into the snowbank, and carbon monoxide came in and killed him.
Mm. Still, you know, as a reporter, you want to get the story on the air, and I've...
But you have,
this
you have,
is more than 20 years ago. I've still been thinking about that. But
you have to mix it in with common sense. I mean, you're in a small town. You would have been out of business with the police department. Yeah. And really, what would you have accomplished? I mean, this captain, if he was doing his job, would have made some sort of disciplinary move, either formal or informal. And many times informal discipline can be much harsher than formal discipline.
Well, let's go back to your police day. You have a New York accent, so you were born and raised.
This is all true. Yes. This is all true. I was born in Brooklyn. I was born on Ostrand Avenue in Brooklyn, and since then I've moved around a lot. I've traveled a lot, but that's where it all started.
You're not from a police family, are you?
Uncle was a policeman. My daughter now is a policeman.
Oh.
I've had a lot of cousins police. In fact, my daughter's out in Crown Heights tonight, and last night, the night before.
She's been all right, I hope.
Yes. Mother calls me every day. Did you hear from my daughter? And I call my former wife. And no, I haven't heard from her, but she's all right. We would have heard.
So was it your intention from the beginning when you got out of school that you would be a cop?
I got out of the Marines after the Korean War, and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. Like a lot of guys, I didn't have a clue. And my father had been through the Depression, and he was always civil service, get security. And the cop and the fire test came around. I decided, yeah, I'll do it. And I took both of them, and I decided I want to be a policeman. And I did.
So you went to the academy,
went to 7-9, first one.
You're in the 7-9?
7-9.
Where is that?
Thompson and Gates. That's where it used to be. Tompkins and Gates, rather. It's a Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Uh-huh.
Very busy shop. Was there for a while. And then I was put into the detective division. I was in the detective division for many, many years. Then I came out, I made sergeant in 67.
Detective sergeant?
No. I did detective work, but detective sergeant, you get extra money. A lot of people, lieutenants and sergeants in the detective division, they all don't have the money. So technically they're detective sergeants, but they're not, because they're not getting the extra money. There's only the city charter only allows a complement of so many detective sergeants. You are a detective sergeant, but you're not getting the money.
So you went back to the uniform post, as
yes. No, I wasn't uniform. I was doing special work in the precincts.
Special work?
Yes. I was doing community relations work and stuff like that.
What were some of the crimes that you investigated as a detective?
Oh, everything.
Homicides?
Everything.
Everything.
Everything. Everything. In fact, in one police plaza, the homicide over the woman with the curtain rod was an actual homicide that I worked on. And we worked on that case for 2 years. We knew the guy who did it, but we could never prove it. Could never get enough evidence to go into court. Very frustrating. Because that's a cop's job, and that's what happens.
So you made sergeant, and then what?
Lieutenant.
Then lieutenant.
And then I ran the 108 Detective Squad in Queens for a long period of time. And then I got out, and I started to write.
So you retired when?
I'm out since 84.
And did you start writing after you left the
department? No, I was writing while I was in the police department.
Did you publish while you were in the police
department? One Police Plaza.
You published that while you were actually...
While I was out, I was working, and my agent said, you got to make a choice now. You're an established author. You, by a miracle, you broke through on your first book, which is, you know what that is. It's rare, but it happens on occasion. And I decided I had 30. That's enough.
You know, I know Joe Wambaugh.
Yeah.
And he was telling me that he published his first book, the title of which escapes me. The Onion Field, I think.
It was the New Centurions?
I'm not sure.
No, it was a marvelous book.
I have to check my file now. I can't remember now. But he had constant problems with his supervisors. They did not approve of his writing. He wrote in a very candid, frank style. More than just a thriller. I mean, some of his cops were not...
They were wonderful. They were so real.
They were real, but they didn't... Some of them were not savory, like any group of people.
Well, yeah. Same in the NYPD. Some of them are not savory.
That's right. And they wanted him to clear anything he wrote, and he didn't want to do it, and they busted him, and they took him out of the detective squad. They put him back on a beat. He said he went through hell, and finally... It got bad enough that he just had to quit. And they gave him every crappy assignment they could give him in order to harass him.
Basically, that's jealousy. It's jealousy. He writes about cops. He writes the way cops are. Bottom line is a cop is out there going to put his life down for somebody else, to save somebody else, with all their flaws, with all their carrying on, with all their craziness. They're still out there to protect life and property, and they do that. I was down One Police Plaza this morning, and the rotunda there is filled with plaques with cops killed in the line of duty. You know, and Wambaugh wrote about the way it was. And but I think LA's a different town anyway. They're different people.
But you never ran across any opposition about that.
I will tell you, in all honesty, I never had one iota of problem in the New York City Police Department. Not one. They all wished me well. They still wish me well. That's from the police commissioner down. And they never interfered. I can call up and ask for something. I get it. I can ask to go out, and I want to go out with this detective squad. I mean, now I'm a civilian. I just can't do it. I have to sign safe, harmless agreements in case anything happens to me. I save the city from any harm. But I can do whatever I want, as long as it's legal. Never, ever, ever have I had any problem with the New York City Police Department.
And in fact, you probably became a celebrity within the department while you were still...
I did, yeah. But all New York City cops are celebrities.
Well, yes, they are.
They're a special breed.
That One Police Plaza, that was really a successful book. That was filmed, too, wasn't it?
It was filmed. The Robert Conrad was in it. Then they did a sequel with James Farentino and Jennifer O'Neill. And I was involved with both projects. And I got a lot of respect for the movie industry. They're very professional people through that. I used to hear a lot of bad-mouthing them in publishing, a lot of writers. But they're very professional. They know what they're doing. And they did well. In fact, One Police Plaza was on television last night.
It
was, and I watched it again.
What channel? I wish I'd...
Life Channel.
Oh, I don't know if I get that.
Yeah, and I watched it again. I saw myself.
Did you play a
role? Oh, I have a cameo. A la Alfred Hitchcock. A little cameo. I get off on that. That's my ego, to see myself in the movies.
Oh, I think that's a hell of a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. In fact, the next movie I'm involved in, I'm going to have a scene someplace where I can have my daughters and my grandchildren sitting on a park bench or something. That's real ego.
Well, I think if any of your books are filmed, you ought to take the lead.
I'm not an actor. I can't act.
I can act down. You've got the right voice.
I can act down the street. When I'm a cop, I can act. But in front of a movie camera, I don't have it. It takes a lot of actors really fascinate me, how they can change. How they, I create with words, actors really. But when you're watching people and actors do it, they're talking to you and the next minute they can be somebody else. And believably somebody else. Well, that's another gift. That's a gift you have to have.
I have a feeling, though, a lot of the Hollywood movies, especially movies that you see made for television, are not too realistic in terms of...
Well, not. They're shot, you know, they're shot, what, in 30 days?
Low budget. Hill Street Blues was...
That was wonderful.
It was a good show.
That was wonderful. I don't know why they took that off. It was making money.
It's
I guess
good.
It was losing. Yeah, you're
if
right.
It's too good, it's not going to last.
You know the only thing good on television? The Muppets. The Muppets and I, Claudius. Channel 13 will have good things occasionally. The rest of it is, I don't know who they make it for. They make it for space cadets and brain-dead people.
Well, fortunately, I have cable, so I I tape movies from Showtime and American Movie Classics.
They're wonderful.
In fact, oh. I'm taping this afternoon The Return of the Invisible Man, 1940.
Like, why can't they do that now?
And yesterday I taped Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy because I saw that when I was a kid.
Right.
I've been taping all the Abbott and Costellos because
right.
I grew up with
right. I
loved Abbott
them.
And Costello
they were so
in the
wonderful.
40s.
That's so did I. Yeah. I remember when Costello's child was drowned in his pool.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I don't really know anything about them. But I just saw, last week I just saw... probably the best Abbott and Costello movie called The Time of Their Lives.
I remember that.
And I'll tell you why that has kept with me all of my years. When I was a kid, and it was made about 1942, 43, 44, something like that, Costello and a woman companion are murdered by revolutionary soldiers, and their bodies are thrown down a well. And I was shocked because I'd seen lots of Abbott and Costello movies, but here they're actually shot to death and their bodies thrown down the well. Costello comes back as a ghost and haunts the mansion where the well is. And Abbott comes back as a man in the current, you know, who is a psychiatrist and is visiting the mansion on a holiday, you know. And Costello haunts him. It turns out to be a very funny movie, but it was so shocking to see Costello being murdered and then dumped in a well. And I remember that all these years, and I didn't even know what movie it was. I couldn't remember until I saw it last week. Isn't that crazy?
Well, we remember things from our childhood. I remember how green was my valley.
Yeah.
I went to see that. I remember The Seahawk with Errol Flynn. I thought that was the greatest movie in the world. And even now, when they died with their boots on with Errol Flynn. I was a big Flynn fan.
Well, let's go back to you. And do you miss the... you retired after, you say, 30 years?
Yeah.
You miss it at all?
No. I had it. It's enough. It's enough. And it's a young man's job. And just before I got out, I was chasing a burglar on a rooftop. And I grabbed the guy, and I'm rolling across the roof with him. Subduing him with my little blackjack. And I remember, clear as anything, thinking, what the hell am I doing here at my age? I shouldn't be doing this. No, it's just for young people, and I don't miss it.
Police work has always struck me as a mixture of occasional excitement and horrible tedium.
You're absolutely correct, except in New York City. Cops in New York City go from job to job. There's very little tedium. They're very, very busy. Listen to the radio call in each division. Radios, they go from job to job. They never, never, never. There's very little tedium. On the late tours during the winter sometimes, it just slows up a little bit.
I think the New York City police are wonderful. I've had a lot of doings with them, both professionally and personally. I had a relative who got involved in drugs, and that just caused all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
And I can tell you the police in the 24th Precinct where I work and where I live, just terrific. They talk to you.
Cops are terrific.
Occasionally there were problems. I remember once I had this relative stole a number of items, including an expensive ring and so forth. And my wife and I said, this is it. You know, we're going to report this to the police. So I went, and they steered me to a clerk who made me wait for about an hour. And I described the missing objects, described the thief, And she said, well, that's it. I know. I said, I want a police investigation. I want an arrest made here. We can't do anything like that. And I was furious, so I finally went to the desk sergeant, and I explained the situation, and he sent me upstairs where I talked to a detective, and sure enough, they made the arrest.
Yeah.
But what was this clerk getting involved here? She's not a police person.
They're so overwhelmed with crime in New York City. They have a policy that certain cases are just reported and they don't act upon them. They just don't have the manpower. Someone comes in and reports the theft of $50 ring or $200 watch, they're basically not going to send people out on that. They have floods of homicides. We're leading the...
Oh, I know.
You know, we have people on homicide investigations, narcotic investigations.
But these were large thefts. I mean, they weren't $50. I'm talking about thousands of dollars and in my particular case. And they did make an arrest in this particular case. And the crime was important to us.
Absolutely. I understand that. You're absolutely right.
And it should not have been sloughed off. And
you're absolutely right.
I wrote and I sent a carbon to the police commissioner and so forth, for which the detectives involved were very happy. They even called me. They even called back to see how things were going. So they were very, very good in this particular instance.
Cops like to help people. I've seen policemen extend themselves in many, many ways to help people. Incredible ways. They're very, very compassionate people. They might not look compassionate. They might have their big pot belly, some of them, with the gun belt down, but they're compassionate people, want to help you. And they do help you. And in New York City, they're really highly trained. And they're motivated. They're well supervised, very important. And as you can remember, after the stun gun incident out in Queens, everyone, you know, the bosses here are responsible for their subordinates.
I've noticed something when a sergeant hooks up with a patrolman.
Yeah.
He always takes the patrolman's book.
And signs it.
And he reads it.
Yeah. A cop's memo book is like a ship's log. Has the same force and effect. You report every incident. Every police action that you take is to be listed in that memo book. And those memo books are serially numbered. So you just can't take, you know, start another one and forward something. You turn that one in, then you get another serially numbered memo book and you sign for it. And that's the ship's log. And you, when you're out on patrol, you are a ship. And any action you take has to be an entry.
Or observe.
The
sergeant is to examine it.
And the sergeant examines it, and he signs that book to show that he supervised you at that particular time. Well, if a higher-ranking supervisor comes around, say, during a late tour, and he goes around, he sees all the memo books, say, 7 a.m., and they're not signed, he's going to ask why. There might be a legitimate reason why the sergeant didn't sign them. You know, there are many things can happen that preclude you going around signing books. But if there's not a legitimate reason, he's going to take a piece of you. Because you're supposed to do that.
I can understand that, because you really have to keep a high degree of organization within the department, know where your people are and what they're doing. Otherwise, there could be anarchy. You can't just let them go out there and walk around by themselves.
Policemen are the most powerful people in this country. A lot of people don't realize that. They forget that. A policeman on the beat has more power than the President of the United States or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He is the only person in this country empowered to take a human life right then and there, right on the street. He can take that gun out and shoot and kill someone if he has justification. The President can't do that. The President can't assassinate anyone. The President has to ask Congress for a declaration of war. And once you give a person that authority, you have to, and you damn well better, maintain strict supervision. If you don't, you're going to have problems. He has to know when he can use that gun. He has to know that if he takes that nightstick and smashes somebody's head open, he's allowed to do it if it's legal. But if he's not legally obliged to do it, then he better be held accountable for it.
And they are.
Here they are.
And there are plenty of cops who are in prison as a result of a misuse of authority.
Absolutely. The 106 is a prime example, a stun gun. Everyone went. Borough commander, the chief patrol, the chief of patrol, right under the police commissioner, guy in charge of the entire patrol force, the New York City Police Department, out. Because the policy in the New York City Police Department is that you are responsible for the conduct of your subordinates. Period. I think it's probably the same way in industry, in business, at least it should be.
I don't understand the situation in Crown Heights. I don't know if it's the new police commissioner, Lee Brown, or Dinkins, where they've allowed this violence to go on and on and on. Cops being pelted. Some of them were shot with a shotgun. Eight of them were shot the other night with a shotgun.
I know.
And yesterday I edited the news conference that Lee Brown had, in which he finally said they are now prepared to make mass arrests. I think they made close to 90 arrests overnight. That's really not a mass arrest when you think of the hundreds of people rampaging through that neighborhood. But why in the world weren't the police able to act in a way to stop those riots?
The police are able to act in a way to stop those riots, but they have to be given the orders to do it. And that is a political decision by the commander-in-chief, which is the mayor.
Well, he made the wrong decision not to do it.
Well,
three nights of rioting, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Well,
you got to stop it.
I like the mayor in many ways, but he's weak in some ways, in my judgment. And he tries to be nice to everyone, and you can't do that. You know, you got to be tough sometimes.
And, well, when you have mobs murdering people, overturning cars, setting them on fire, looting stores, well, you can't allow that.
No, and
there's no justification for that.
A lot of those people are not from that community anyway. They're paid agitators. But a lot of these self-anointed community leaders who live out of state, they bring their mobs in, they pay them, they're paid to riot. Actually, that's what they're doing. They know that. The police department knows that. But they don't act on it.
Well, if I were the mayor, I would have had a fleet of school buses standing by. I would have had these people arrested, taken to an armory for processing.
They have those plans. They have contingency plans for that. Exactly. That's exactly what the contingency plans call for. But you have to remember that this is the police department, as it should be, serves under civilian control. And the chief executive of the city is the boss. He calls political shots. A lot of times they will do things for political reasons.
Well, they may also be worried that there might be a repetition of this Tompkins Square Park problem where the police got out of control. And
police didn't get out of control.
Yes, they did.
No, they didn't.
It's well documented that the police in that particular instance beat people and...
What about the rocks that were thrown at the
cops? There were rocks thrown.
Okay.
The police... No, it's well established. All of the subsequent reports, even within the department, indicated that the police were not prepared and well supervised. One of the top cops, in fact, had gone back to the station to relieve himself and just stayed, and they weren't supervised. There were other problems too. I read the report. Where cops were called in from other boroughs. When they got there, they didn't know where to report, and they had to try to go through the mob trying to find a supervisor and. They were cut off, and it was...
They have to be supervised on those same things. And the problem is a lot of... They're not supervised. Now they're supervised. They have a whole new procedure. But again, the orders have to come from the chief executive.
Well, they got out of hand there. But another problem, too, I think, if I recall the report correctly, there hadn't been a real major civil disturbance like that since the 1960s. And a lot of these cops were younger, and they hadn't had any experience in trying to deal with these crowds of agitators. And believe me, I mean, there's no question that there were people trying to incite problems there.
Some people in this town think they have a God-given constitutional right to riot and to rape, burn, and pillage. They don't. And the police department is there to stop it and to prevent it. But they have to have the go with green light from civil authority, at least from the police commissioner. Someone has to say, stop it. And when you have politicians with their own political agendas, they're not going to allow you to do it. And they hold the cops back. Or you had three nights in Crown Heights.
Well, Bill, let's go back. We're almost out of time. I just want to ask you a couple of other questions about writing now that you're... Where do you live, by the way?
I live in Manhattan.
Manhattan?
Yes. And I have an apartment and a dog and a typewriter.
A typewriter?
Yes. Please.
Old-fashioned way of writing.
I don't know any writer who makes his living writing fiction who does not use a typewriter.
No, they use computers.
They use computers not to write. Very few of them do. You can write with a computer.
Oh, you have to write with a computer.
Why do you have to?
It's so time-consuming to write with a typewriter.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. When I write in longhand, and then I go to the typewriter. I don't want to be bound down having to know that I got to push this button, PF1, PF9, and what the hell is this button for? It just distracts me. I'm in another world when I'm writing, and I don't want anything that's going to block me from entering my world of fiction. And that's what those damn computers do. Plus, they're complicated. Plus, you can lose everything on a disk.
Only if you're careless.
Well,
I was
I'm
talking
careless.
To a poet you may have read his name, James Dickey. He wrote
yes.
Deliverance. And Dickey, he collects typewriters.
Yeah.
He says he has a typewriter in every room and usually has a project on each typewriter.
That's right.
He goes from room to room and he types. And I was trying to encourage him to get a computer. And
I just don't.
He said, this is what he said. He said, first he said, I don't want to get a computer. He said, I want to, every draft of a poem that I do, I want to see them side by
Absolutely.
Side.
Absolutely.
I said, well, you can do that with a computer. He said, but I'll have to learn to use a computer.
That's right. That's right. It's just time consuming. It's just a pain in the neck. It's not the same. It's not writing.
Of course, if you were a kid today, you'd
That's
study
different.
Computers in high school, and that would just be a
That's different.
Life.
It's second nature to them.
If you look in, when we go through our newsroom, you look in there, we don't have typewriters.
Yeah.
We use computers.
Well, as I said, every writer I know, every fiction writer I know, and I know a hell of a lot of them, they use typewriters. A few will have them for rewriting. Now, I have a woman who types for me, mm-hmm. who, when I give her my typed manuscript, she puts it in a computer. So when I make changes, when I edit, when the manuscript is complete, it's easier. I don't have to rewrite, but when I do that, I will have already retyped that manuscript at least 10 times, at least.
The entire manuscript.
Yes, sir. I do a lot of rewriting.
When you wrote One Police Plaza, did you have an agent then, or did you sell it yourself?
I had an agent. I have been blessed in the publishing business by wonderful people. I never thought I'd be a writer. I thought I was going to retire from the police department and teach school. I'm certified to teach. And, in fact, I used to substitute teach at moonlighting when my children were younger. I was at a party, and I met a guy named Tony Godwin, who was the editor-in-chief of a large publishing house and very renowned in the industry. I did not know this. I just thought it was a crazy, crazy Brit I met at a party. We were telling war stories, and he was talking about the Blitz. I was talking about being a cop in Bedford-Stuyvesant. He said, you got some line of crap. Do you think of being a writer? I said, no. He said, I think you might be a good writer. He said, why don't you write me some? I said, write you what? He said, write me a story. I said, what the hell do you mean write your story? He said, just start a story and send it to me. And I started One Police Plaza. I sent him a chapter, and he edited and sent it back, and he said, it's awful. He said, it's horrible. He said, you think people read with their lips. You overwrite, use too many adjectives. You don't know how to develop personality. You don't know how to, you can't spell. He says, look at these adverbs. But the last, very last sentence was, despite all the above, you have talent, and I'll work with you. I saw that, and I said, I'm going to be a writer. That's how I got started. And Tony introduced me to my agent. Now, I didn't know that this guy, who he was, but his imprimatur opened a lot of doors for me. I was painted with his brush, and that opened a lot of doors because of his stature in the industry.
Ah, it's a wonderful story.
True story. And then I worked 7 years writing that book. I wrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And Tony died, and the woman who took his spot was named Marion Wheeler. And she tried to get it published with the same house. And one of the women read the first 100 pages of the manuscript, you know, one of these literary types, snooty literary types. And she sent Marion back a note and said, I suffered through 100 pages of this cop stuff. She says, it's god-awful. I can't believe we're committed to this. Please advise. So when One Police Plaza came out, and Marion left there, and by accident, she sent me the file, and that note was included in that file. And I saw it, and I said, well, I'm going to teach her. And I wrote. Now I was really mad. And One Police Plaza, I sold it. Crown bought it. I sold it. It came out. It jumped on all the bestseller lists. And I sent her a copy with a Xerox of that her note. And I said, you see, you were wrong, kiddo.
So it was not the original house where the woman wrote this note that published the book?
No. No, it was a different house. It was HBJ. That Tony worked for HBJ, but Tony died, and Marion worked for HBJ. And then...
ultimately, you sold it to Crown.
I sold it to Crown.
Crown published all of your books.
Crown publishes all my hard, and Bantam does the soft. And I've been with the same people. And it's like family to me. Crown is a wonderful, wonderful company. The people there are dedicated. They're hardworking. I've never seen such hard workers. I can go there on a Sunday. There'll be people from the art department, and they're doing that stuff.
Well, William Connors, my last question.
Yes, sir.
The title of the book, Exceptional Clearance. What does that mean?
Every time someone reports a crime, by federal law, that crime has to be recorded, and it has to be cleared. This is for the National Crime Statistics. There are many ways of clearing it. Exceptional clearance is a very special way to close a case when you know who the person is who committed the crime, but that person is outside of your reach, i.e., guy does a homicide in New York City and flees to Colombia. There's no way you're going to extradite.